Welcome to Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now, here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome to Beyond Words Radio, where it's our ambition to move beyond simply talking about the Christian faith to walking it. That is to be faithful in a world of change and great challenge. One of our challenges, of course, is the rise of terrorism and, I'm going to make a little bit of a linkage here, the Islamic faith. Not that it's been rising up recently. Islam has a long history, 1,400 years, and there's something very interesting happening in our day. And I think what you hear now will encourage you. Wherever you're coming from in life, whatever your station in life, this will be an encouragement to you. We have with us as guest Dr. David Kashin. David is a professor at the Columbia International University. He deals with the Muslim faith. He was actually a missionary with his wife for 9 years in Bangladesh. He has a lot of history. And David, I'd like you to explain the story. But first of all, welcome. Thank you for being with us
today. Well, thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate the opportunity.
So how did you develop interest in this whole area of Muslim studies? You've written a book, you've been teaching on it, you've done missions. Where did all this come from?
Well, it really began in the 1960s. I was not raised in a Christian family, and my dad was invited to Saudi Arabia in the late 60s to start a Department of Chemical Engineering at one of the universities there. And I went as a high school student to boarding school in Beirut, as did my sister. That's where our Christian odyssey began. My sister was led to Christ by the navigators in Beirut, and then she led my mother to Christ in a hospital in Saudi Arabia, actually, after a terrible automobile accident that we were involved in India. After that, we came back to America, and I met the Lord through Campus Crusade for Christ, and then eventually even my dad as well became a follower of Jesus, left his atheism and followed Christ. So it's been an exciting process, but the process was somehow wrapped up with the Muslim world, with the Middle East. And very shortly after my conversion, the Lord seemed to be speaking to me about my future and working with Muslims. And there were many ways in which he confirmed that over the next couple of years. And so my wife and I have been given to working amongst Muslims for the last 40 years.
Wow. Bangladesh, what a challenge. I understand, is that not the poorest country in the world?
Well, it used to be, but Bangladesh has come up a long way. They're now, I think, 143rd in the list of nations. But when we were there, it was known as the poorest nation on earth, per capita income well less than a dollar a day, a huge amount of poverty and suffering and difficulties. And our work, of course, was to work with Muslims there. That's where our heart is. And God was doing a wonderful thing amongst the Muslim in Bangladesh and is still doing so. Many, many Muslims have turned to Jesus Christ in Bangladesh, and it's a growing movement. It has many struggles. There's a lot of persecution, and that persecution is increasing. But it's part of the ongoing harvest that we see all across the Muslim world. Muslims are turning to Jesus in a way that has never been seen in world history. As one person put it, more Muslims have been converted in the last 30 years than in the previous 1,400. So it's a very exciting time, and we're very grateful to God that He gave us that calling for our lives.
I'm right now reading a book that I've had recommended to me for a couple of years, and A Wind in the House of Islam, and I know you also recommended it, and I heard you speak recently, but David Garrison's work unpacks a lot of that with research and sound data, doesn't it?
Yes, David Garrison's a good friend. We've been in a number of conferences together, and in that book, he essentially goes through the major linguistic houses of Islam. He calls them the nine houses. You have a South Asian Islamic house. You have a Turkic Islamic house. You have an Arabic Islamic house. And he points out that there are in excess of 70 movements going on in each, in all of those houses of Islam, where more than 5,000 Muslims have met Christ in the last 10 years or so. He goes into much more detail on this, but it's a very encouraging book to realize that it is harvest time in the Muslim world. The Spirit of God is doing remarkable new things. I might also mention another book by an author who is a real favorite of mine. Nabil Qureshi wrote a book entitled Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. And this is probably the best book in English that I've ever read that describes in depth the movement of a devout Muslim from faith in Islam to faith in Jesus. And it culminates with dreams and visions that bring him to a place of conversion to Christ. And a highly recommended book for Christians everywhere to read.
Dr. Keshan, before we go forward in this interview, I just want also for you to please mention your most recent book. Tell the listeners about it, how to get a hold of it, what's it focus on?
Yeah, this book is about 5 years old. I wrote it basically doing research on Prophet Muhammad and the nature of his relationship with Jews and Christians and how it changed over time. So it's a chronological reading through the Quran, where you see the Quran's development over time. And it also deals with the traditions and the so-called sunnah, the pathway or the behavior of the Prophet. The final chapter in the book really grapples with some of the arcane and difficult and unfortunate aspects of Islamic law, primarily the whole area of sex slavery. Now, at that time when I wrote the book, this didn't seem to be a problem anywhere in the Muslim world until ISIS came along, and everything that I describe in that final chapter, ISIS is doing. What I was saying in that chapter was if the Muslim world wants to join the 21st century and become more moderate, they have to grapple with some of these more vicious and nasty aspects of their Islamic law. And at that point, nobody was practicing that, so I was kind of a little bit out on a limb, you know, talking about that. And yet ISIS has come along and said, well, that's what Muhammad did, so we will do that. And they have made that a very relevant question. How is Islam going to become moderate in the 21st century without rejecting some of the really, really vicious aspects of Islamic law?
I've heard some apologists defending Islam in the midst of all the terrorism say, well, people are misreading the Quran because actually it starts in its early, it's almost a chronological telling historically, isn't it? And there's a shift from the early parts where there's more a push for violent jihad. And as it goes along, it seems to morph into a gentler religion. Do you agree with that?
Actually, you are doing the exact opposite. And I think you know that's not how the Quran progresses. You have two major sections to the Quran, the Meccan surahs, which are about half of the Quran. And they are generally the shorter chapters of the Quran that you find towards the end of the Quran. And then you have the Medinan surahs, which are also about half of the Quran. And those chapters of the Quran are primarily found at the start. The Quran is not laid out in chronological pattern, but it is laid out in according to importance. So the most important chapters occur first. And these are mostly chapters from the latter half. So when you're reading the Quran, you're kind of reading backwards through history. And within Islam, there has been a progression that moved from a period of quiet preaching to a period at the end of the Prophet's life where he becomes a religio-political military leader. And he establishes the kingdom of God, which is what Islam is. It's a kingdom principle based on coercive violence. And that's just a simple fact. And when you read through the traditions of Muhammad, all of which were promulgated during the Medinan period, during that latter half of the Prophet's work, all of these clearly indicate Islam as a political system, and all political systems, including democracy, are based on coercive violence. So there is a huge element of that in the latter parts of the Quran. That is the real difficulty with Islam. It's possible for you to quote passages that sound very nice. Even chapter 2 talks about there's no compulsion in religion. But what you need to understand there is the compulsion he's talking about is the compulsion that says once we have conquered you, we don't force you to convert to Islam, but you must confess our political hegemony over you. And Islam is politically hegemonistic. Muhammad was the founder of an empire. And when you look at passages that you think sound like they are tolerant. If you scratch them and consider them deeply, they are anything but tolerant. I mean, even our own president, when he quoted chapter 5 of the Quran, where if you kill anyone, it's as if you kill the whole of humanity. In actual fact, in the context, there is lots of talk of killing people. And when you read the tafsir or the commentary literature on that passage, you find out that when Muhammad says kill anyone, the phrase is really kill anyone who is a follower of Allah. Okay, that's a great sin. But to kill infidels, to kill pagans, well, that's actually honored in that very same passage. So when you say that people accuse us of picking and choosing out of the Quran, it's actually the other way around. Our president and his advisors very carefully plucked out certain verses that sounded good, and you really don't understand what they mean if you don't read them in their whole context and understand what the Islamic commentary literature says about those things.
As a bit of an aside to our main trail, I think listeners will be greatly interested to hear your opinions on Donald Trump. How is it that this man who seems to blow a lot of hot air and not have a lot of knowledge about politics continues to ride high in the polls?
Well, first of all, just a bit of a disclaimer. I have no interest in Donald Trump, and in fact, I really don't like the things that he says and the things that he advocates. But I do think that Trump has not crashed and burned the way anyone would have expected him to for a very simple reason. And we can sum that up in the words of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln once said that you can fool some of the people all of the time, and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. And the average American today has been told over and over and over again by the administration and by Islamic leaders of various types that Islam is a religion of peace. This has nothing to do with Islam. This is, as the president put it, 0.1% of the Muslim world population. And a lot of Americans are saying, you know what? That doesn't make sense. In fact, that sounds like denial. Probably enough of them have watched, Dr. Phil's program to know the statement that if you cannot solve a problem, that you're unwilling to acknowledge. And clearly, Muslim leaders here in the West and our politicians are in denial. They're not willing to admit the problem. And the problem is that Islam is based, and I'm saying Islam as a religion, it is a political system that is based on coercive violence. And we've seen 40 years of that. Well, we've seen 1,400 years of that. But in the last 40 years, we've had the hostage crisis. You know, this was a government, the Iranian government, taking a large group of American diplomats as hostages for 444 days. We're not talking about Islamic radicals here. We're talking about governments. You look across places like Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Pakistan, the blasphemy laws of Pakistan, where the government has basically said anyone can be killed at any time because they've even said the slightest word of critique towards Islam. What you end up with by this denial is a situation where any criticism of Islam is called Islamophobia. And the basic word is you need to shut up. Well, how does this help Islam to reform if it's never subjected to freedom of speech and critique? And I think most Westerners, and even some Muslims, listen to Donald Trump and they say he's onto something. There is something wrong here that we're not being told. And you combine that with a level of fear from all of the, you know, mass killings. And I watch all of ISIS's films because I do research on ISIS propaganda. This is the first group in world history that's proud of its atrocities. They make films of them. And they display it for the whole world to see. So this creates this atmosphere of fear and distrust, coupled with the fact that most Americans have a sense in the back of their minds, how many suicide bombings have we had? Now, you know, I've never seen a journalist try to count them. Why not? There's a sense that people are avoiding the issue. They're hiding from the issue. Well, I would guesstimate that we've had more than 50,000 suicide bombers. That makes the kamikazes of Japan look like child's play. But nobody talks about this. And most Americans are scratching their head and they're saying, you know what? No smoke without fire. There's a fire here someplace. And you look across the Muslim world today And it's a devastating picture. Somalia is a failed state. Syria is a failed state. Iraq is well on its way to being a failed state. Libya is a failed state. Algeria is a failed state. And all of these are states that all scream Islam. They just literally scream it. That's our focus. That's who we are. And even amongst Muslims, increasingly, there is this move towards something other than Islam. And in many cases, it's either Christianity or secularism, because they're looking at that. And the Muslims themselves, when they go into the source documents, they say, ISIS may be radical, but they're not an impossible interpretation of Islam. They may not be the only interpretation, but they're a perfectly good interpretation of Islam based on the actual practices of the Prophet. And it's really partly because of that that so many Muslims are turning to Jesus Christ, turning away from Islam, because really what ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab and the Ayatollahs of Iran and the people in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabis, they have really ripped the face mask off of Muhammad, and they've shown him as he is to the world, the real historical Muhammad.
So what do you say then, Dr. Kashian, when a leader of Islam in America is putting a good face on this movement and they say, you know, ISIS does not reflect who we are?
Well, in a very real sense, of course they don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's obvious. But when I've asked Muslims a more pointed question, which journalists never do, part of the multiculturalism thing, you basically tell the person, well, tell me what your faith is, and then they sort of accept as true whatever is said to them. That's the fallacy of postmodernism. But when I've gone to mosques, and I've been to many mosques, I've talked and debated with many Muslim leaders, I'll ask them a simple question. What does ISIS do that Muhammad didn't do? And they generally have two answers. The first is, this has nothing to do with Islam, which is the exact same talking point as Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. This has nothing to do with Islam. For most of us at this point, that's not an adequate answer. We're saying, I'm sorry, that's a person reflecting that they are in denial. Hmm. They're refusing to acknowledge the problem, which means they can't solve it. They're just continuing it. The other answer that they'll generally give is they're killing Muslims. Now, that answer is one that, of course, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama would echo. They say, look, here's a group who slaughtered thousands of Muslims, and most of the people they're killing are Muslims, and that's true. But it also makes the American a little bit nervous for a couple of reasons. The first is the only thing that's important the fact that Muslims are getting killed? You see, it's kind of a narcissistic viewpoint that Muslims, when they talk about what's wrong with ISIS, only talk about the killing of Muslims. What about the killing of Yazidis, or Jews, or Christians, or pagans, or secularists? Why isn't that first on the list? Or what might be even more poignant, why not talk about the sex slavery, the systematic rape of thousands of Yazidi women? That isn't mentioned. And there's a reason why it isn't mentioned. It's part of the Sunnah of the Prophet. That's what I illustrate in my book. That is what Muhammad did, not only gave his soldiers permission to do, but which he did himself, personally. So in that circumstance, you can't criticize him. It's one of the reasons why Al-Azhar University, which is the university that sponsored Barack Obama's speech in 2009, they have never issued a condemnation of ISIS. Because everything that ISIS does is found in Islamic literature, in their Sharia, in their source of law. Even the killing of Muslims, because what the ISIS people will say is they have not killed any Muslims. These are not Muslims. These are munafiq. These are hypocrites who are not followers of Islam. Now, obviously, at this point, we're getting into a more complicated area because it's an internal thing between Muslims, who's a real Muslim and who isn't. But this problem is reflected in the Quran itself. When Muhammad was preaching in Mecca, and there's no coercive violence involved, the word munafiq, or munafiqun in plural, hypocrite or hypocrites, doesn't occur. When you get to the Medinan period, where Muhammad is using coercive violence to establish his political state concept, suddenly the word munafiqun appears. And the reason is easy to understand. In an environment of assassinations and coercive violence, it was important for you to feign allegiance to Islam to keep from getting killed. And Muhammad began to realize this. Lots of people were feigning allegiance to Islam who weren't really converted to Islam. So then the question was, how do we figure out who's a true Muslim and who is not? And chapter 9, verse 111, gives the answer to that. He is a true Muslim who is willing to fight, kill, and be killed in jihad. Obviously, a hypocrite doesn't want to go out into battle and fight, doesn't want to die for a religion at heart that he doesn't believe in. That became Muhammad's litmus test of a true Muslim. And that's exactly what ISIS has done. They're saying, if you're not with us in the jihad, then you're a munafiq, or you as a group are munafiqun, and you are not Muslim. You are what they would say is you are takfir, which is their word for excommunicate. We excommunicate you from Islam because you are not engaging in the jihad, and therefore we may kill you freely. So ISIS would say, we've not killed any Muslims. We've only killed people who were hypocrites.
So a lot of listeners probably do carry fear in their hearts. The threat of terrorism is ever present, and it's amorphous. It's hard to track this new kind of warfare, and we wonder, how can we be safe? And it sounds nice to be nice and not to confront the Islamic State and the whole ideology behind it. Is that what you recommend, that we just back off and just kind of do? You've mentioned leaders in our current presidential administration, that we just put a good face on it and relax, and everything will be fine. Do you feel that way?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the problem with that is it's a denial of the two cardinal rights of the United States Constitution, freedom of speech and freedom of religion. The way that religions are held accountable for their actions is through the freedom to criticize them. No one would agree with the idea that we should suppress all information about the Catholic Church. You know, no one is saying that Catholicism should be spared any analysis over the pedophilic priest problem simply because that would give people a negative view of Catholicism or lead us to be Catholicophobes. But the term Islamophobe is used to suppress all critical appraisal of Islam. It is, in essence, the death of freedom of speech. And if ever there was a religion in desperate need of an honest critique, it is Islam. Islam is a religion that has never been subjected to a fair critique from the outside. And you hear that even in our president's talking points. He essentially repeats the Islamist talking points when he talks about ISIS. He says two things. They have nothing to do with Islam, and they're killing Muslims. And I hear the same thing from Muslim preachers that I speak with all around the United States and around the world. They use the exact same argument. And those are arguments that are based on no freedom of speech. Just shut up. That won't work. The ideology needs to be confronted. There needs to be an ideological struggle. And I would argue, the president, of course, says that Trump, or Mrs. Clinton is saying that Trump actually is helping ISIS by his viewpoint. I would say Trump is irrelevant to ISIS. What is important to ISIS is that no one is allowed to criticize Islam. And the fact that they can preach their Islam without any fear of anyone criticizing what they're saying is one of the reasons why so many young people are joining it, because it seems to be the winning horse. It's the horse that no one can criticize. So if you're an angry young man and you want empowerment, this is the way to go. So I would argue the viewpoint that says Islamophobia and don't criticize Islam is the attitude that is supporting ISIS primarily.
What do you recommend a person does if they think, okay, I need to confront this ideology, but I don't know what to say? Where do they begin?
Well, two important things. I think it was George Washington who said that democracy depends on a well-informed electorate. And American electorate today is not well-informed. The media is involved in a cover-up with regard to Islam. Anything negative about Islam, they tend to cover up. particularly when it comes to ideological questions. They'll only go to the mosques to hear what the leaders of the mosques have to say. And they work out of an assumption that's a very postmodern assumption, that whatever someone from a different religion tells you about their religion must be true. And of course, that's totally false. There is a huge level of propaganda being carried on in America, and there needs to be critical, independent thinking. And in my way of thinking, the only way to do that is to go back to the original Islamic source documents and begin to read them. In one sense, I'm grateful that Trump is as ignorant as he is. If he had any idea what is in the Islamic source documents, he would be dangerous. And I mean that he would be dangerous for Muslims in America. I think Christians need to take the lead on this. They need to begin to read the Islamic books. One of the ones that I would recommend is Ibn Ishaq's Life of Muhammad. It is available from Oxford University Press. It's the earliest biography of Muhammad written by a Muslim. I use it as an evangelistic tool. When Muslims tell me that Muhammad was the most wonderful, the most gentle, the most loving, the most kind, the most perfect human being who ever lived, I will give them a copy of that book and say, please read this and tell me what you think. It is accurate. It is Islamic propaganda. About 130 years after the death of Muhammad was when it was written. But it tells stories that are so horrendous and that you see reflected in our modern struggle with Islamic terrorism. Muhammad takes hostages. Muhammad executes hostages. Muhammad subjugates people at the point of the sword. Muhammad leads battles all across. And it's offensive warfare, not defensive. It's clear that Muhammad receives permission when he goes to Medina to engage in offensive war of conquest. So this thing that it's only defensive war in jihad is completely false. And you see that very clearly when you read these oldest Islamic documents. Muhammad allows his soldiers to rape the women prisoners of war. Gives them, says that's perfectly fine. And try to make them pregnant in the process, because then you make them into ummul walads, that is, mothers of believers, for demographic hegemonism, to control the areas that they've taken over. I've had Muslims convert through reading that book. Even imams. Because they suddenly realize we've been following a different Muhammad, what I like to call the Muhammad of devotion, who is an invention of a later age, who never really existed. And what ISIS is doing is reintroducing, or it doesn't, not just ISIS, I would say all of the different terrorist organizations, as well as the governments of Saudi Arabia and Iran and Pakistan and all these other nations, are essentially revealing to the Muslim people the Muhammad of history, the real Muhammad. And in that process, those people are discovering he isn't the guy that we thought he was.
David, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to ask, and I hope you all will stay on with me, because I'm going to ask you how we should respond to the wave of refugees being brought in from Syria, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. To discover more about Beyond Words and the other ministries of Scripture Awakening, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com. While there, you can learn about our amazingly successful Bible reading program, B90, or Bible in 90 Days. You can review the extensive catalog of our versatile Bible study series titled Be Next. You can also download free podcasts from all Beyond Words programs. Check out B90, Be Next, and Beyond at scriptureawakening.com. Here once again is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome back to Beyond Words Radio. We're glad you're with us this morning as we tackle some very difficult issues around the topic of the Islamic faith and extremism and terrorism and how that affects our lives today. We have with us Dr. David Cashin. He's been a missionary with his wife in Bangladesh for a number of years. He's had ministry for 40 years to Muslims, and he's a professor at the Columbia International University in South Carolina. David, As we go forward in this topic, I think listeners would be very interested to hear your opinion on refugees that are being brought into our country from the Syrian crisis.
Well, we do know that Muslims are coming to faith in large numbers across the world, and particularly refugee Muslims who are leaving the Islamic State, the paradise on earth where Sharia is fully and completely and consistently followed, the law of Islam, and they're abandoning it because it doesn't work. It's a system of violence and death and destruction. And so these refugees, I believe, are open to the gospel. Now, it's true there are probably some ISIS followers who are trying to get in that way. We know at least one who came into Paris to lead the Paris attacks. Nevertheless, we have to recognize that many of these people are deeply discouraged with Islam. Mm. In Sweden right now, the largest revival that has happened in 100 years is going on right now. And it's primarily Muslims turning to Christ.
It's a Christian revival.
A Christian revival of Muslims becoming Christians. The largest portion are Iranians. About 9,000 Iranians have become Christians. But there are hundreds of Afghanis who've also become Christians. And there are Syrian Arabs. In fact, one of the Syrian Syrian refugee who came to Sweden a number of years ago has become a Christian and is one of the pastors of my son's home church in Västerås, Sweden. So there's been a huge turning of Muslims to Christ, and this is really an opportunity. People who lived in a country where they could never hear the gospel because the government suppressed the gospel have now come to the West, and they have an opportunity to hear the gospel. And ISIS has been, they have been proto-evangelists for us. Now, what I mean by proto-evangelists, that doesn't mean that they like Christianity. They certainly don't. They hate it. But they have prepared the way for the Christian message. They have revealed the Muhammad of history. They have revealed what Islamic law really means. And the Syrian people have had enough of it. And that's why they've run away. They're looking for another way. And that's our opportunity as Christians. So as Christians, we need to banish fear. We have to admit that the number of people actually killed by Islamic terrorists, with the exception of 9/11, has been relatively small. So the danger to us on a percentual level is probably less than the danger from being hit by a drunk driver, far less. So if we're still willing to get in our cars and drive on the highways, we should also be willing to befriend and to share the gospel with Muslims. And this is our time to do that.
What about the idea of the cells, ISIS cells forming in America, and maybe there being an uprising to have a mass attack on the country?
In the United States, I think that's mostly hot air. Europe would be more vulnerable to that because the European security services are so weak compared to the American ones. I think certain smaller European countries could be overthrown by coup d'etat, Sweden being one. Could very easily be have their government overthrown by coup d'etat. However, that coup wouldn't stand because the other nations would send in military forces. They'd probably call on the United States, and it wouldn't stand for any length of time. So in the American circumstance, I don't see any possibility of that happening in the immediate future. This is why I think we are still acting from a position of strength. Islam is, I mean, you've got to admit, Islam has been doing the worst PR campaign that's ever been done in world history. And it scared a lot of people off of Islam, but it's also really discouraged large numbers of Muslims as well. This is the time to be loving Muslims and to be sharing the gospel with them, because now they can see the difference.
I really appreciate what you are saying, loving Muslims. Mm-hmm. One could become fearful and defensive and rather aggressive when hearing some of these facts that you're bringing to the fore. But you as a Christian are saying, now let's face reality without fear and be like Christ, who loved everybody.
Yeah.
And he spoke the truth to them.
Yeah.
Have you found that Muslims are more receptive to an honest dialogue with truth being brought to the fore? Or are they more receptive when love means kind of weak and don't you dare confront their ideology?
Yeah. Well, my thought is this. There are basically two wings of the Christian church dealing with Islam. We have what I call the dialogical wing, and then we have the more evangelistic wing. Neither of those are motivated by fear. Both are motivated by a deep calling to preach the good news of Jesus to every nation, and that includes every tribe, tongue, people and nation of Islam. Now, I do think there are some problems with the dialogical approach. I have many friends who've been engaging in that and having dialogues with Muslims where they meet together and they talk about similarities in their faith. And what I find about these meetings is that they rarely get to the differences. So they're not very enlightening. And in fact, postmodernism has a real, excuse me for using this big word, epistemological problem. And the problem is that we think that sameness is a source of knowledge. You know, and you hear this anytime there's a terrorist event and someone blames the Quran, journalists are quick to point to similar passages in the Bible and say, you know, Joshua 6:21, kill everything that breathes. So you don't throw stones if you're in a glass house. Well, that is basically a strategy to make people shut up. And it's also very disingenuous because the problem, the primary question is not, how is Islam similar to Christianity? The problem and issue is, how is it different? And the difference is as simple as two people, Muhammad and Jesus. Okay? When did Jesus say kill people? When did Jesus say rape people? And if you look across the Christian world today, where do we find sex slavery, you know, argued for by Christians? Where do we see Christian suicide bombers? So there's a huge difference here. And the problem with the dialogical school is they don't know how to confront the differences. Now, Muslims look upon themselves as lions. That's their most common sort of animal reference. What is a Muslim like? A Muslim is a lion. He is totally bold and aggressive about his faith. Christians are trained to be lambs. And the dialogical viewpoint fits in with that, but I hate to say this. The person who behaves like a lamb towards a Muslim is rarely going to inspire that Muslim to turn to Christ. And I've seen that with friends who've been doing dialogue for 30 years and who will admit personally to me they've never seen a Muslim meet Christ. Now, this doesn't mean that I'm going after the Muslim with an argumentative lifestyle. What my viewpoint is, I do show the love of Christ, and I always have a smile on my face, and I'm not feeling defensive in any way. I have a number of television programs that are available online where I've debated Muslims, and you'll see that I'm very happy about what I'm doing. I'm not at all upset or defensive or aggressive in the normal sense of the word. But my approach is to ask some simple, good questions, like, what does ISIS do that Muhammad didn't do? And I'll let my Muslim friend blather off, this has nothing to do with Islam and he's killing Muslims, or ISIS is killing Muslims, which I've heard, you know, dozens of times. But I know that in their heart of hearts, they know that isn't an adequate answer. So I've actually said to Muslims pretty boldly, you know, I don't think you can solve a problem that you're not willing to acknowledge. And I've read, you know, Ibn Ishaq's Life of Muhammad. Have you read it? And sometimes I'll even just point out, here's some passages. Explain this to me. Now, this is not the same as a riling attack on Islam. I'm not here to say, you know, Muhammad was a rapist. I mean, he just did what was normal for his period of time. World conquerors naturally raped the women that they captured. That was normal behavior for those who were establishing empires. The problem, of course, is if Muhammad is a perfect example, then that's how we should behave today. That's where the problem lies. So my point is to ask really good questions and to not accept every answer that I receive as being a complete answer, because it isn't. Most of the time, it's an expression of denial, and it's an expression of cover-up. So I think Christians, first and foremost, need to preach Jesus. And so when I've witnessed to Muslims and debated them, my debates have been primarily about the nature of Jesus. I did one debate on the virgin birth in Islamic and Christian viewpoints. I did one on prophecies concerning Jesus from Muslim and Christian viewpoints. So my main point is to preach Jesus, and Muslims are deeply attracted to the person of Christ. But at the same time, if they're going to come to Jesus, they have to do a critical appraisal of Muhammad in their own hearts and minds. And I've got to provide them with enough information without being too sharp, but gently nudge them towards that. You see this in Nabil Qureshi's conversion to Christ. One of the things that really shocks him is when he goes into some of the stories of the life of Muhammad and he finds out about the rapes. And he's shocked. He can't believe it. Nobody ever told him that the Prophet engaged in that kind of thing. Now, it's not a Christian who's saying that to him, your prophet is a rapist. Well, that wouldn't be smart. But to say, well, what do you know about the foundations of what ISIS is doing? Have you listened to ISIS propaganda? I think this is a time for Christians to be bold, to be as wise as serpents, but innocent as doves. Wise as serpents mean we know how to ask really hard questions that get Muslims to look at their own sources and ask some hard questions about them. And I think that part of the process of conversion is sowing doubt about what you've been taught. And Muslims have been taught a Muhammad who did not exist. He is an invention of a later age.
In an earlier radio program some months ago, we brought a guest on who talked about the bridges of similarities between Christianity and Islam. And I know there are organizations, mission groups, that focus heavily on that. Are you saying that's a bad thing to do?
Well, I'm saying bridging is always needed. You know, the most primary bridge that a Christian has with a Muslim is the Muslim's fear of Allah. They have a deep, profound fear of Allah, and that's not a bad thing, but it hasn't been modified by an awareness of where Allah's grace and mercy is to be found. So bridging is helpful to create common ground for discussion. But if that's where you stop,
there you go.
You have this position that essentially says everything that you need to know for salvation is available in Islam. And it isn't. Islam denies the vicarious atonement of Jesus Christ, denies the cross, denies the sonship. These are all things that John says in 1 John are absolutely essential to salvation. He who has the Son has life. He who has not the Son has not life. And the reality there is all of this discussion is couched in familial language. Father, son, adopted child of God, son versus slave, if you're thinking Romans chapter 8. The essential reality of the New Testament message is that we become the children of God. And such we are, the apostle says, by adoption. Islam does not have this. There is no familial language regarding God in Islam. There is no way of knowing or experiencing God. Ismail Faruqi put it this way. A Muslim, he's a great Islamic thinker of the 20th century, a Muslim cannot know God. A Muslim does not know God in any way. The only thing that we can know about God is his law, which is why Muslims are so preoccupied with Sharia, with law, because that's all you can know. And the Bible, the Christian Bible, 253 times uses the verbs know and knowing as describing how human beings can know and experience God. And by inference, you can find this thousands of times. Knowing God, knowledge of God, inference to that is found nowhere in the Quran. It does not exist. So if you're going to preach the good news of Jesus, you can't get there by a bridge alone. You have to illustrate what Islam is missing. And Islam is missing the adoption into eternal life that is assured because we have come through the grace of God given to us in Jesus Christ. And I think at this stage in history, this is a message that is powerfully appealing to Muslims because they're having Sharia rammed down their throats. And it's clear that Sharia is religious apartheid, the separate and unequal treatment of people based upon their religious beliefs. It is the suppression of freedom of speech. It is the suppression of freedom of religion. 27%, according to the Pew Foundation, of Muslims worldwide think that a Muslim who leaves Islam should be punished and even killed for doing so. Clearly, this is coercive violence, and it's endemic. It's all across the Muslim world. The only way out of that is to recognize the truth of the good news of Jesus, that you can't get to God by the works of the law. By the works of the law shall no flesh be justified.
When I was a college student, David, I was deeply impacted by Madame Bilkis Sheikh.
Yes, and I dared to call him Father.
Yes, the name of her book. And she spoke to our little fellowship, and I was so intrigued. I drove her home and spent time with her. And I'd like to say that if ISIS, the Islamic State, the terrorism that with other organizations that's going around the world with the Islamic base, if this is provoking people to leave Islam and to open their hearts towards something new, mm-hmm. what we need as a Christian church is to draw them forward. We need to be like Bilkis Sheikh. She had a deep relationship with God. Her testimony, of course, mm-hmm. as you know, yeah. and to the listeners, it's that in Islam, I didn't know God personally. I thought it would be heretical to declare a possibility that I could call my God Father. Yes. And to know him now personally has changed my life. And I thought, as a Christian, and at this time I was in college, I don't know him the way she does. Mm-hmm. And it sent me in a deep, almost a tailspin at first, thinking, what of all these years have I been thinking when the great commandment says to love God with all of your heart? Yeah. And I'm not there. This is the first commandment. Here's an ex-Muslim teaching me the way. I've got to get on board. So if we could get our focus right and get close to God, our very lives will be a drawing card, but then our words should help them find those stepping stones into a relationship with Jesus Christ.
Right, right. Yeah, she her book is really a rebellion against the impersonal foreboding Allah of Islam. Let me tell you about one other book that's very similar to this. Mm. It's entitled The God of Justice. It's now a rare book, but it was written by a fellow named Daud Rahbar. Daud Rahbar was an Urdu Sufi poet who, as a young man in the 1960s, researched the nature of God in the Quran. He did it in Europe, actually. And he concluded by writing a thesis entitled The God of Justice, in which he concluded that the God of Islam is a God of unmitigating justice. There's no way that you can know whether you can get any Rahman or Rahim, whether you can get any mercy or compassion or grace. He is pure justice. And Rahbar made a statement that was very powerful. He said, and I quote, "I cannot worship a God who does not understand human suffering." Hmm. And the God of Islam has absolutely no concern for human suffering. You know, every act that a Muslim does is supposed to be prefaced with the phrase, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the merciful and the compassionate. I have watched ISIS films where people were being beheaded. Hmm. And as the executioner is about to behead them, he says the Bismillah. He says, in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, wham, off goes the head. And you think to yourself, where's the mercy?
Yeah.
Where's the compassion? And that's the point. In Islam, they are meaningless titles that have no demonstration. So this God could not care less about human suffering. He seems to relish it. He seems to enjoy it. He is a terrorist. As Christians, we need to banish the thought of terrorism. Terrorism is just a strategy. Mm. You know, Blitzkrieg was a strategy in World War II that the Germans employed with great ability. We didn't go to war in World War II with Blitzkrieg or against the strategy of Blitzkrieg. We went to war against Nazism. Mm. And in the same way, it's not our calling as Christians to go to war against terrorism. Terrorism is just a tactic. It's a strategy, and by the way, a very effective one. You could say that our entire Western world now kowtows to Islam because of it. They are terrified. They are devoid of the power to resist because they've been told to shut up, and it's all their fault, and it's a blame game, and it's all because of Western colonialism, and, you know, George Bush invaded Iraq, and there is some truth to this. But George Bush did not create ISIS. Islam created ISIS. That's the Islamic response. Hmm. And so for the Christian, we should banish all fear. And we should give ourselves to the task of loving Muslims and showing them a better way. And that better way is Christ. It's the only way. And frankly, we are the only solution to this problem. The Western world, with its obfuscation and its political correctness and its Islamophobia, frankly, I think they are the Islamophobes. I'm not afraid of Islam. I love Muslims. Mm. I think Barack Obama is Islamophobe, and so is Hillary Clinton, because they ascribe to the religion too much power, as if somehow it's unassailable. Mm. As Christians, we have a reason and a drive that is perfect love casting out fear, and that says Muslims need to respond to Jesus. And frankly, even if all Muslims on the planet were terrorists, we'd still be called to love them. Mm-hmm. Now, the vast majority of Muslims are not. Most Muslims are just people who want to get on with their lives. And they are people whose lives have been destroyed by Islam. Mm. So now's the day for Christians to share that good news with Muslims.
The opportunity is unprecedented in our day, is it not? It's just amazing to see. When you, going back to the book, A Wind in the House of Islam, the early part talks about the history and how little movement there's been for 1,400 years for Islamicists to come to believe in Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. What's happening today, as you mentioned at the outset, is phenomenal.
Yeah.
We should be very encouraged and take hold of the opportunity. David, can you recommend to our listeners who are saying, I've heard these book titles, I'm not a reader, give me some simple tools, Dr. Cashin. How can I get more educated? Are there particular websites, places they can watch videos on YouTube? Give them some other hooks to get them started in a journey of learning, to lose the fear, to gain knowledge, and then with love to reach out and help change lives.
Well, my simplest resource is something they can get from me. Get out your pen and pencil now, because I'm going to give you an email address. It's a very simple email address. It's dcashin, that's dcashin, D, you can cash in with cashin, dcashin at ciu.edu, that's Columbia International University.edu, or education. So dcashin at ciu.edu. I have a little simple one-page description of how to start a Bible study with a Muslim, how to invite a Muslim to study the Bible with you. And my promise to anyone who does this is that I will mentor you in that process. Mm. I'm very happy to have all the Bible studies pre-prepared, and I'll walk you through the process of what's involved. I have run into many Christians who were so full of trepidation and fear, and then the first time they asked their Muslim friend, would you like to study the Bible with me? They received a powerful, positive response. Now, this isn't always going to happen. But friends, it's happening with increasing frequency that Muslims are searching for a way out. So get in touch with me about that. I have other resources. We also have at CIU an agency called the Zwamer Institute. And we have both podcasts and blogs and other educational materials that you can access from that website. You can ask me about that by sending an email to me at my email address, and I'll put you in touch with the Zwamer site. Many other opportunities like that. I think the key is to figure out where you're at in terms of your knowledge, and then I'd be happy to take you from wherever you are to wherever you need to be. This is a struggle that has to do with knowledge. You need to learn the difference between Islam and Christianity, and be able to show that difference both to Muslims as well as to our multiculturalist friends who like to think that there is no difference.
Mm. Excellent. We have just a few minutes more. You have a very positive attitude, which I greatly appreciate. It's the biblical attitude. We serve a sovereign God who not only made the universe, but he reigns over it.
Right.
And he promises us a good outcome, even with evils in the world. And in this show, you've helped us to see that the evil of Islam is already being used for good.
Yes.
We're seeing it around us with a great movement of people away from a faith that is pseudo-Christian. It was a borrowing from the Christian and Jewish faiths, and people are coming back to the roots, to Jesus Christ, which is built in Judaism, but he's the fulfillment of it. So what an exciting time. Help us out with a little more optimism. Give some positive words. You've mentioned to me, I heard last night, about ways that an individual can get on the internet and be an evangelist.
Yes. You know, it's possible to reach Muslims anywhere on the globe today. We had some of our students who decided they wanted to meet Muslims in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. I'm not going to tell you the process to do this because I don't want to give anything away to our enemies, but send me an email and I'll show you very simply how you can access the internet in such a way to begin dialogue with Muslims in Mecca. And my friends actually met 20 different Muslims in Mecca that they shared the gospel with. And here's an interesting point. You know, the new electronic web materials that are sent out, Bibles and the like, you can actually track where those website materials are. And recently, there was an interesting web notification that some Christians discovered that their Bible that they had sent out to a particular person was circumambulating the Kaaba. In other words, the fellow was circumambulating the Kaaba and reading the Bible off of his iPhone.
Wow.
It's becoming impossible for Islam to close, to prevent the message of Jesus to get through. What we need more of is Christians who illustrate what Jesus is like by being Jesus for Muslims. Think about how Jesus would respond to Muslims. That's where you get your positivity from. Jesus took the people that were his enemies and he made them into friends. He took people that were far from God and brought them into relationship with God. And it's God's calling to you to be Jesus for Muslims. You are the only Jesus they will ever meet. So this is our time to walk in that attitude that Christ would have us have, of deep love for Muslims and a passion to tell them the good news of Jesus.
Dr. David Cashin, thank you so much for giving us your time and so much inspiring information.
Well, Bill, thank you so much. Is it Reverend Campbell?
Whatever you want to make
it. I didn't get your title. Well, you can call me Dave. I'll call you Bill.
Okay.
Thanks so much for giving me this opportunity to share with you today. I really appreciate it. And I do want to be praying for those who send me emails as well, that God would enable them and strengthen them in this ministry.
Thank you.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. And Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. Visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com, where you can download free podcasts of all Beyond Words programs.